This is Audible.
Zondervan presents 1,000 Gifts, A Dare to Live Fully Right Where You Are by Anne Voskamp, read by the author.
Chapter 1. An Emptier, Fuller Life. Every sin is an attempt to fly from emptiness. Simone Weil, Gravity and Grace. A glowing sun orb fills an August sky the day this story begins, the day I am born, the day I begin to live. And I fill my mother's tearing ring of fire with my body emerging, virgin lungs searing with the air of this earth, and I enter the world like every person born enters the world, with clenched fists. From the diameter of her fullness, I empty her out, and she bleeds. Vernix creaks and squalling, I'm held to the light. Then they name me. Could a name be any shorter? Three letters without even the flourish of an E. Anne, a trio of curves and lines. It means full of grace. I haven't been. What does it mean to live full of grace? To live fully alive? They wash my pasty skin, and I breathe, and I flail. I flail. For decades, a life, I continue to flail and strive and come up so seemingly empty. I haven't lived up to my christening. Maybe in those first few years, my life slowly opened, curled like cupped hands, a receptacle open to the gifts God gives. But of those years, I have no memories. They say memory jolts awake with trauma's electricity. That would be the year I turned 4. The year when blood pooled and my sister died and I, all of us, snapped shut to grace. Standing at the side porch window, watching my parents' stunned bending, I wonder if my mother had held me in those natal moments of naming like she held my sister in death. In November light, I see my mother and father sitting on the back porch step, rocking her swaddled body in their arms. I press my face to the kitchen window, the cold glass, and watch them, watch their lips move, not with sleep prayers, but with pleas for waking, whole and miraculous. It does not come. The police do. They fill out reports. Blood seeps through that blanket bound. I see that too, even now. Memory's surge burns deep. That staining of her blood scorches me, but less than the blister of seeing her uncovered, lying there. She'd only toddled into the farm lane, wandering after a cat, and I can see the delivery truck driver sitting at the kitchen table, his head in his hands, and I remember how he sobbed that he had never seen her. But I still see her, and I cannot forget. Her body, fragile and small, crushed by a truck's load in our farmyard, blood soaking into the thirsty, track-beaten earth. That's the moment the cosmos shifted, shattering any cupping of hands. I can still hear my mother's witnessing scream, see my father's eyes shot white through. My parents don't press charges, and they are farmers, and they keep trying to breathe, keep the body moving to keep the soul from atrophying. Mama cries when she strings out the laundry. She holds my youngest baby sister, a mere 3 weeks old, to the breast, and I can't imagine how a woman only weeks fragile from the birth of her fourth child witnesses the blood-on-gravelled death of her third child, and she leaks milk for the babe, and she leaks grief for the buried daughter. Dad tells us 1,000 times a story after dinner, how her eyes were water clear and without shores, how she held his neck when she hugged him and held on for dear life. We accept the day of her death as an accident. But an act allowed by God? For years, my sister flashes through my nights, her body crumpled on gravel. Sometimes in dreams, I cradle her in the quilt Mama made for her, pale green with the hand-embroidered Humpty Dumpty and little Bo Peep, and she's safely cocooned. I await her unfurling and the rebirth. Instead, the earth opens wide and swallows her up. At the grave's precipice, our feet scuff dirt and chunks of the firmament fall away. A clod of dirt hits the casket, shatters over my little sister with the white blonde hair, the little sister who teased me and laughed, and the way she'd throw her head back and laugh, her milk-white cheeks dimpled right through with happiness, and I'd scoop close all her belly-giggling life. They lay her gravestone flat into the earth. A black granite slab engraved with no dates, only the 5 letters of her name, Amy. It means loved one. How she was. We had loved her, and with the laying of her gravestone, the closing up of her deathbed, so closed our lives. Closed to any notion of grace. Really, when you bury a child, or when you just simply get up every day and live life raw, you murmur the question soundlessly. No one hears. Can there be a good God? A God who graces with good gifts when a crib lies empty through long nights and bugs burrow through coffins? Where is God, really? How can he be good when babies die and marriages implode and dreams blow away dust in the wind? Where is grace bestowed when cancer gnaws and loneliness aches and nameless places in us soundlessly die, break off without reason, erode away? Where hides this joy of the Lord, this God who fills the earth with good things? And how do I fully live when life is full of hurt? How do I wake up to joy and grace and beauty and all that is the fullest life when I must stay numb to losses and crushed dreams and all that empties me out? My family, my dad, my mama, my brother and youngest sister, for years, we all silently ask these questions. For years, we come up empty. And over the years, we fill again with estrangement. We live with our hands clenched tight. What God once gave us on a day in November slash deep, who risks again? Years later, I sit at one end of our brown plaid couch, my dad stretched out along its length, worn from a day driving tractor, the sun beating and the wind blowing. He asks me to stroke his hair. I stroke from that cowlick of his and back. His hair ringed from the line of his cap. He closes his eyes. I ask questions that I never would if looking into them. Did you ever used to go to church? Like a long time ago, Dad? Two neighboring families take turns picking me up, a Bible in hand and a dress ironed straight, for church services on Sunday mornings. Dad works. Yeah, as a kid I went. Your grandmother had us go every Sunday after milking was done. That was important to her. I keep my eyes and his dark strands of hair running through my fingers. I knead out tangles. But it's not important to you now. The words barely whispered, hang. He pushes up his plaid sleeves, shifts his head, his eyes still closed. Oh. I wait, hands combing, waiting for him to find the words for those feelings that don't fit neatly into the stiff ties, the starched collars of sentences. No, I guess not anymore. When Amy died, I was done with all of that. Scenes blast. I close my eyes. Rio. And if there really is anybody up there, they sure were asleep at the wheel that day. I don't say anything. The lump in my throat burns, this ember. I just stroke his hair. I try to soothe his pain. He finds more feelings. He stuffs them into his words. Why let a beautiful little girl die such a senseless, needless death? And she didn't just die. She was killed. That word twists his face. I want to hold him till it doesn't hurt, make it all go away. His eyes remain closed, but he's shaking his head now, remembering all there was to say no to that hideous November day that branded our lives. Dad says nothing more. That shake of his head says it all. Expresses our closed hands, our bruise-shaking fists. No. No benevolent being, no grace, no meaning to it all. My dad, a good farmer who loved his daughter the way only eyes can rightly express, he rarely said all that. Only sometimes, when he'd close his eyes and ask me to stroke away the day between the fingers. But these aren't things you need to say anyways. Like all beliefs, you simply live them. We did. No God. No God. Is this the toxic air of the world, this atmosphere we inhale, burning into our lungs, this no God? No God, we won't take what you give. No God, your plans are a gutted, bleeding mess, and I didn't sign up for this, and you really thought I'd go for this? No God, this is ugly, and this is a mess, and can't you get anything right and just haul all this pain out of here, and I'll take it from here. Thanks. And God? Thanks for nothing. Isn't this the human inheritance, the legacy of the garden? I wake and put the feet to the plank floors, and I believe the serpent's hissing lie, the repeating refrain of his campaign through the ages. God isn't good. It's the cornerstone of his movement. that God withholds good from his children, that God doesn't genuinely, fully love us. Doubting God's goodness, distrusting his intent, discontented with what he's given, we desire, I have desired, more, the fullest life. I look across farm fields. The rest of the garden simply isn't enough. It'll never be enough. God said humanity was not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and I moan that God has ripped away what I wanted. No, what I needed. Though I can hardly whisper it, I live as though he stole what I consider rightly mine. Happiest children, marriage of unending bliss, long content, death-defying days. I look in the mirror, and if I'm fearlessly blunt, what I have, who I am, where I am, how I am, what I've got, this simply isn't enough. That forked tongue darts, and daily I live the doubt, look at my reflection and ask, does God really love me? If he truly, deeply loves me, why does he withhold that which I believe will fully nourish me? Why do I live in this sense of rejection, of less than, of pain? Does he not want me to be happy? From all of our beginnings, we keep reliving the garden story. Satan, he wanted more, more power, more glory. Ultimately, in his essence, Satan's an ingrate. He sinks his venom into the heart of Eden. Satan's sin becomes the first sin of all humanity, the sin of ingratitude. Adam and Eve are simply, painfully, ungrateful for what God gave. Isn't that the catalyst for all my sins? Our fall was, has always been, and always will be, that we aren't satisfied in God and what he gives. We hunger for something more, something other. Standing before that tree, laden with fruit withheld, we listen to evil's murmur. In that day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened. Genesis 3:5. But in the beginning, our eyes are already open. Our sight was perfect. Our vision let us see a world spilling with goodness. Our eyes fell on nothing but the glory of God. We saw God as he truly is, good. But we were lured by the deception that there was more to a full life. There was more to see. And true, there was more to see. The ugliness we hadn't beheld, the sinfulness we hadn't witnessed, the loss we hadn't known. We eat, and in an instant we are blind. No longer do we see God as one we can trust. No longer do we perceive him as wholly good. No longer do we observe all of the remaining paradise. We eat, and in an instant, we see. Everywhere we look, we see a world of lack, a universe of loss, a cosmos of scarcity and injustice. We are hungry. We eat. We are filled and emptied. And still, we look at the fruit and see only the material means to fill our emptiness. We don't see the material world for what it's meant to be, as the means to communion with God. We look and swell with the ache of a broken, battered planet, what we ascribe as the negligent work of an indifferent creator, if we even think there is one. Do you ever think of this busted-up place as the result of us ingrates, unsatisfied, we who punctured it all with a bite? The fruit's poison has infected the whole of humanity, me. I say no to what he's given. I thirst for some Robrant, some elixir, to relieve the anguish of what I believed. God isn't good. God doesn't love me. If I'm ruthlessly honest, I may have said yes to God, yes to Christianity. But really, I've lived the no. I have. Infected by the Eden mouthful, the retina of my soul develops macular holes of blackness. From my own beginning, my sister's death tears a hole in the canvas of the world. Losses do that. One life loss can infect the whole of a life. Like a rash that wears through our days, our sight becomes peppered with black voids. Now everywhere we look, we only see all that isn't. Holes, lack, deficiency. In our plain country church at the edge of that hayfield enclosed by an old cedar split rail fence once a week on Sunday, my soul's macular holes spontaneously heal. In that church with the wooden cross nailed to the wall facing the country road, there God seems obvious, close. Bibles lie open. The sanctuary fills with the worship of wives with babies in arms, farmers done with chores early, their hair slicked down. The communion table spread with the emblems, the singular cup and loaf, that table that restores relationship. I remember. Here I remember love and the cross and a body, and I'm grafted in and held and made whole, all's upright. There, alongside Claude Martin and Anne Van den Bogart and John Wyler and Marion Schefter and genteel Mrs. Leary, even the likes of me can see. But the rest of the week, the days I live in the glaring harshness of an abrasive world, complete loss of central vision. Everywhere a world pocked with scarcity. I hunger for filling in a world that is starved. But from that garden beginning, God has had a different purpose for us. His intent, since he bent low and breathed his life into the dust of our lungs, since he kissed us into being, has never been to slyly orchestrate our ruin. And yet I have found it. He does have surprising secret purposes. I open a Bible, and his plans, startling, lie there barefaced. It's hard to believe it when I read it, and I have to come back to it many times, feel long across those words, make sure they are real. His love letter forever silences any doubts. His secret purpose, framed from the very beginning, is to bring us to our full glory, 1 Corinthians 2:7. He means to rename us, to return us to our true names, our truest selves. He means to heal our soul holes. From the very beginning, that Eden beginning, that has always been and always is to this day his secret purpose. Our return to our full glory. Appalling that he would. Us, unworthy. And yet, since we took a bite out of the fruit and tore into our own souls, that drain hole where joy seeps away, God's had this wild, secretive plan. He means to fill us with glory again. With glory and grace. Grace, it means favor. From the Latin, gratia. It connotes a free readiness. A free and ready favor. That's grace. It's one thing to choose to take the grace offered at the cross, but to choose to live as one filling with his grace, choosing to fill with all that he freely gives and fully live, with glory and grace and God? I know it, but I don't want to. It is a choice. Living with losses, I may choose to still say yes. Choose to say yes to what he freely gives. Could I live that? The choice to open the hands to freely receive whatever God gives. If I don't, I'm still making a choice. The choice not to. The day I met my brother-in-law at the back door, looking for his brother, looking like his brother, is the day I see it clear as a full moon rising bright over January snow. That choice, saying yes or no to God's graces, is the linchpin of it all, of everything. My brother-in-law, he's just marking time, since farmer husbands made a quick run to the hardware store. He's talking about soil temperature and weather forecasts. I lean up against the doorframe. The dog lies down at my feet. John shrugs his shoulders, looks out across our wheat field. Farmers, we think we control so much, do so much right to make a crop. And when you're farming, he turns back toward me. You're faced with it every day. You control so little. Really. It's God who decides it all, not us. He slips his big Dutch hands into frayed pockets, smiles easily. It's all good. I nod, almost say something about him just leaving that new water tank in the back shed for now, instead of waiting any longer for farmer husband to show up. But I catch his eyes, and I know I have to ask. Tentatively, eyes fixed on his, I venture back into that place I rarely go. How do you know that, John? Deep down, how do you know that it really is all good? That God is good? That you can say yes to whatever he gives? I know the story of the man I'm asking, and he knows mine. His eyes linger. I know he's remembering the story, too. New Year's Day. He asks us to come. Only if we want. I don't want to think why, but we know. Already? I search my husband's face. Today? He takes my hand and doesn't let go. Not when we slide into the truck, not when we drive the back roads, not when we climb the empty stairwell to the hospital room lit only by a dim lamp. John meets us at the door, He nods. His eyes smile brave. The singular tear that slips down his cheek carves something out of me. Tiff just noticed Dietrich had started breathing a bit heavier this afternoon. And yeah, when we brought him in, they said his lung had collapsed. It'll just be a matter of hours, like it was at the end for Austin. His firstborn, Austin, had died of the same genetic disease only 18 months prior. He was about to bury his second son in less than 2 years. I can't look into that sadness wearing a smile anymore. I look at the floor, polished tiles blurring, running. It had only been 1 year and 6 months before that. The peonies had been in full bloom when we had stood in a country cemetery, watching a cloud of balloons float up and into clear blue over pastures. All the bobbing, buoyant hopes for Austin, floating away. Austin had hardly been 4 months old. I had been there on that muggy June afternoon. I'd stood by the fan humming in their farm kitchen. The fan stirred a happy-faced balloon over Austin's placid body. I remember the blue of his eyes, mirrors of heaven. He never moved. His eyes moved me. I'd caressed my nephew's bare little tummy. His chest had heaved for the air, and heaved less and less. How do you keep breathing when the lungs under your fingers are slowly atrophying? I'd stumbled out their back steps, laid down on the grass. I cried at the sky. It was our wedding anniversary. I always remember the date, his eyes. And now, New Year's Day, again with John, Tiffany, but now with their second-born son, Dietrich. He's only 5 months old. He was born to hope and prayers and the exact same terminal diagnosis as his brother Austin. John hands me a Kleenex. And I try to wipe away all this gut-wrenching pain. He tries too, with words soft and steady. We're just blessed. Up until today, Dietrich's had no pain. We have good memories of a happy Christmas. That's more than we had with Austin. All the tiles on the floor run fluid. My chest hurts. Tiffany's got lots and lots of pictures, and we had 5 months with him. I shouldn't, but I do. I look up. Into all his hardly tamed grief, I feel wild. His eyes shimmer tears, this dazed bewilderment, and his stoic smile cuts me right through. I see his chin quiver. In that moment, I forget the rules of this Dutch family of reserved emotion. I grab him by the shoulders and I look straight into those eyes brimming, and in a scratchy half whisper, these ragged words choke, wail. If it were up to me. And then the words pound, desperate and hard. I'd write this story differently. I regret the words as soon as they leave me. They seem so unchristian, so unaccepting, so, no, God. I wish I could take them back, comb out their tangled madness, dress them in their calm Sunday best, but there they are. Released and naked, raw and real, stripped of any theological cliché, my exposed, serrated howl to the throne room. You know, John's voice breaks into my memory, and his gaze lingers, then turns again toward the waving wheat field. Well, even with our boys, I don't know why that all happened. He shrugs again. But do I have to? Who knows? I don't mention it often, but sometimes I think of that story in the Old Testament. I can't remember what book. But you know, when God gave King Hezekiah 15 more years of life, because he prayed for it? But if Hezekiah had died when God first intended, Manasseh would never have been born. And what does the Bible say about Manasseh? Something to the effect that Manasseh had led the Israelites to do even more evil than all the heathen nations around Israel. Think of all the evil that would have been avoided if Hezekiah had died earlier before Manasseh was born. I'm not saying anything. Either way, about anything. He's watching that sea of green rolling in winds. Then it comes slow, in a low, quiet voice that I have to strain to hear. Just that maybe you don't want to change the story, because you don't know what a different ending holds. The words I choked out that dying ending day echo. Pierce. There's a reason I'm not writing the story, and God is. He knows how it all works out, where it all leads, what it all means. I don't. His eyes return, knowing the past I've lived, a bit of my nightmares. Maybe, I guess, it's accepting there are things we simply don't understand. But he does. And I see, at least a bit more, when we find ourselves groping along, famished for more, we can choose. When we are despairing, we can choose to live as Israelites gathering manna. For 40 long years, God's people daily eat manna, a substance whose name literally means, what is it? Hungry, they choose to gather up that which is baffling. They fill on that which has no meaning. More than 14,600 days, they take their daily nourishment from that which they don't comprehend. They find soul-filling in the inexplicable. They eat the mystery. They eat the mystery. And the mystery, that which made no sense, is like wafers of honey on the lips. A pickup truck drives into the lane. I watch from the window, two brothers meeting, talking, then hand gestures mirroring each other. I think of buried babies and broken, weeping fathers over graves, in a world pocked with pain and all the mysteries I have refused to let nourish me. If it were my daughter, my son, would I really choose the manna? I only tremble, wonder, with memories of gravestones, of combing fingers through tangled hair. I wonder, too, if the rent in the canvas of our life backdrop, the losses that puncture our world, our own emptiness, might actually become places to see through to God. That which tears open our souls, those holes that splatter our sight, may actually become the thin open places to see through the mess of this place to the heart-aching beauty beyond, to Him, to the God whom we endlessly crave. Maybe so. But how? How do we choose to allow the holes to become seeing through to God places, to more God places? How do I give up resentment for gratitude, gnawing anger for spilling joy, self-focus for God communion? To fully live, to live full of grace and joy and all that is beauty eternal. It is possible, wildly. I now see and testify. So this story, my story, a dare to an emptier, fuller life. Chapter 2. A Word to Live and Die By. Eucharist, Thanksgiving, is the state of the perfect man. Eucharist is the life of paradise. Eucharist is the only full and real response of man to God's creation, redemption, and gift of heaven. Alexander Schmemann. I slammed up bright, jolt the bed hard, hands gripping the cotton sheets wild. There's a halo of light by the door. I breathe, heave, breathe. There are stars. I can hear the clock in the kitchen, the one over the dining room table, making time, one loud, sure tick at a time. My chest pounds the hooves of 1,000 stallions running on and away, and the universe outside the window holds, the one struck through with the stars. And I breathe. It was all a dream, a mirage of the moon. I feel my hands across the threads of sheets, and there is a bed, sure, under the body, and there are morning stars all in place out the window, and his bare shoulders rise and fall beside me in the heavy slumber, and the relief courses through my veins draining away the fear blue. It was all a dream. I fall back to the pillow, lie in relief. I don't close my eyes. I stare out the window, and I wonder that there is real breath in these real lungs, and that is the real Red Antares scorpion's beating heart hanging below that waning crescent moon, and I am here to see it. And they were just four nightmares in one night, a silver thread unraveling through black. For me, Jiu says she never has dreams. I lie there and untangle the memory of scenes, the string all twisted, one long strand of nightmares, plagiarizing life, the fibers of the neocortex working through my life, all the life most important. I revisit dream scenes, and I think about this. The all most important. It has seemed real, the dream. It was a faceless doctor, just a voice. It was a pallid room of walls and no windows, and it was just the uttering of one word, and I can feel it again. How the veins constrict. That haunting C word. The one with gluttonous belly and serrated teeth and the voracious appetite to divide and dominate. Cancer. It's a slam to the gut. I grin. And he blandly says the cancer's been invisibly consuming bits and pieces of me while I've birthed the six babies, mopped their muddy prints off the floors, kissed the lips of their father at the door. He says there's nothing to be done. All's been devoured. Just wrap up the last of my living. Already? No more? The heart hammers and the blood surges, scream of electric blue. Gasping, grasping, I had tried to struggle free, to emerge up into life, into the four scone-colored walls, the dim light at the door, the pure white matelassé bedspread pulled up over the valves. How I'd wanted to surface and breathe and keep the skin on and live. But night's noose had tightened, and I'd been strangled back into this dream script of telling the news of my impending demise to husband, father, brother. In terrifying nightmare fashion, they all shrug their shoulders, walk away blithe. I want to live, fully live. What is the message of dreams? I remember it four times, escaping up into consciousness, only for the rope burned back into the choked-out goodbyes and last anguished touches. I lie there long, staring at ceiling, listening to the beat of my untamed heart. This. But this waking to the crack of a nightmare, this violet shock through the veins, even this might be better than the way I usually wake. Since after the six babies, or at least since the third, the first girl and the one with the dimples, when motherhood began to sag me. But really, no, it began years earlier, since the girl with thick glasses in Mr. Cahoon's English class read books to escape thoughts of her mama, sitting up in a psychiatric hospital, aching for the baby that bled through the blankets. Yes. It really has been all those years since then. For years of mornings, I have woken wanting to die. Life itself twists into nightmare. For years, I have pulled the covers up over my head, dreading to begin another day I'd be bound to just wreck. Years, I lie listening to the taunt of names ringing off my interior walls, ones from the past that never drifted far and away. Loser, mess, failure. There are signs nailed overhead, nailed through me, naming me. The stars are blinking out. Funny this, yesterday morning, the morning before, all these mornings, I wake to the discontent of life in my skin. I wake to self-hatred, to the wrestle to get it all done, the relentless anxiety that I'm failing, always the failing. I yell at children, fester with bitterness, forget doctor's appointments, lose library books, live selfishly, skip prayer, complain, go to bed too late, neglect cleaning the toilets. I live tired, afraid, anxious, weary. Years I feel it in the veins, the pulsing of ruptured hopes. Would I ever be enough, find enough, do enough? But this morning, I wake wildly wanting to live. Physically feeling it in the veins trembling, the hard pant of the lungs, the seeing it in the steady stars, how much I really want to really live. How I don't want to die. Is that the message of nightmares and dreams? To live either fully alive or in empty nothingness. It's the in-between that drives us mad. It's the life in between, the days of walking lifeless, the years calloused and simply going through the hollow motions, the self-protecting by self-distracting, the body never waking, that's lost all capacity to fully feel. This is the life in between that makes us the wild walking dead. The sun climbs the horizon. I throw back the covers, take another breath and begin. I get to live. A lone morning dove woos from high in the spruce tree. In the kitchen, I stand over the heat of the stove, slowly stirring the wooden spoon through the bubbling up oatmeal. But my eyes are on the window, on the field. Freshly fallen snow coruscates in the sun, countless stars across fields, trees in the woods falling soundlessly, their blue shadows stretching. Down by the lane where the gravel curves to the road, where that bulk of a yellow lab has been digging hard, steam rises slow off the earth's black loam. Life has mirages of its own. The nightmare creeps up the nape of the neck, clamps me in a chokehold of reality. The end will come. Doctor's warning or not, the end will come, and this life of the bare toes across grass, the sky raining spring down on eyelashes, the skin spread close under sheets, blink of the fireflies on dusky June nights, all this will all end. I turn off the stove. I toss in a load of laundry, pull a recipe book out of the cupboard to plan the day's menu, wipe off the counters. I try to breathe and press on, but I'm rattled, upended, undone. I can't quite shake the reality of the dream, the nightmare of my life. Which road through this brief land? What is all most important? How to live the fullest life here that delivers into the full life ever after? A child tromps in, boots still on, with a chest full of mail. Between the flyers of a grand opening for a new flooring store in town and a sale on tires lies a letter from my recently widowed father-in-law. On a hot night one July in the dark of room 117, God had used cancer to usher my mother-in-law, his bride of half a century, into the throne room in glory ever after. We had sung that night, "What a day that will be when my Jesus I shall see." I had laid the cold cloth on the sweat beads stringing along her brow. I tear open his envelope, slide out the dayspring card, read his slow Dutch scrawl. But it's the last words of his card that grab me. Thinking on the beginning of this year, who does he call to come home? Is it me, Lord? May I be ready? Or us, whoever. Emotion wells, spills. How this letter, these words, and now, after last night's dream wrestle, after my years of mournings, whoever, ready for the end of here, whoever, ready for the first meeting of him there, whoever, soon. Will I have lived fully, or just empty? How does one live ready, and always? Yes, ultimately only Jesus. Yes, this premature dying to self, birthing into the cross life, the grace cocoon before emerging into the life unending. Without this Jesus, no one can be ready. But someone, please give me, who is born again but still so much in need of being born anew, give me the details of how to live in the waiting cocoon before the forever begins. In my reality dream, dream reality? I gasp for more time, frantic for more time. But I have to wonder, more time for more what? The answer to that determines the road these so short days take. Hard questions drive me hard to distraction. Hijack email. More words sent this way, this time from a mother. Her 17-year-old has been diagnosed with, yes, specter of that word too real, cancer. I try to breathe. Today it's hard. What are the messages of God? Her mother types the words across my screen. Any words? I stumble away. Obviously, I have no words, no answers. I'm groping for my own way, desperately feeling along today for a way to live through this fleeting blink of a life. How do we live fully, so we're fully ready to die? I stack the linen closets. I think of all the things I might never live to do. I think of all the things I am going to miss. My eyes will never know China's jade green Lee River. I'm never going to see those black-haired boys under straw-brimmed hats fish off their bamboo rafts with the ringed cormorants, the mist rising behind the karst formations, surreal and dark. I'm never going to be ascending the Loita Hills of Kenya to witness the dance of gazelles migrating up by the millions from the Serengeti. I'm not going to be swimming the sapphire waters of some South Pacific grotto or sitting up late listening to the wind whisper through the sequoia woods, or spending my golden years scaling the summit of emerald Machu Picchu. I run my hand across the thick of the terry towels. I'm a farmer's wife. I'm the homeschooling mother of 6 children. There are no fancy degrees or titles, diplomas hanging on these finger-smushed walls. Are there places that must be known, accomplishments that must be had, before one is really ready? I know the theological answers, but do my blood and my pulse? I remember once sitting at the hairdresser's. The woman beside me reads, and I read her title in the reflection of the mirror, 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. Is that it? Are there physical places that simply must be seen before I stop breathing within time, before I inhale eternity? Why? To say that I've had reason to bow low? To say that I've seen beauty? To say that I've been arrested by wonder? Isn't it here? Can't I find it here? These very real lungs will breathe in more than 11,000 liters of air today. And tonight, over our farm, will rise the great hexagon of the blazing winter stars. Sirius, Rigel, Ruby Aldebaran, Capella, the fiery Gemini twins, and Procyon. Scarlet Betelgeuse, the red supergiant larger than twice the size of Earth's orbit around the sun. And I will embrace the skin of a boy child that my body grew from a seed. The low heavens outside the paned windows fill with more snowflakes than stars, no 2 stacked crystals the same. The trees in the wood draw in collective green breath to the still of January hibernation, and God in the world will birth ice from his womb, frost of heaven, bind the chains of the Pleiades, loose the cords of Orion, and number again the strands on my head. Job 38:31, Matthew 10:30. Isn't it here, the wonder? Why do I spend so much of my living hours struggling to see it? Do we truly stumble so blind that we must be affronted with blinding magnificence for our blurry soul sight to recognize grandeur? The very same surging magnificence that cascades over our everyday here? Who has time or eyes to notice? All my eyes can seem to fixate on are the splatters of disappointment across here in me. I close the bathroom linen closet, pick up a brush to swish toilets. I don't need more time to breathe so that I may experience more locales, possess more, accomplish more, because wonder really could be here for the seeing eyes. So, more time for more what? The face of Jesus flashes. Jesus, the God-man with his own termination date. Jesus, the God-man who came to save me from prisons of fear and guilt and depression and sadness. With an expiration of less than 12 hours, what does Jesus count as almost important? And he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to them. Luke 22:19. This. I live in this place, make porridge, scrub toilets, do laundry, and for days, weeks, I am brave. And I do get out of bed and I think on this. I study this, the full life, the being fully ready for the end. I start to think that maybe there is a way out of nightmares to dreams. Maybe. I run my finger across the pages of the heavy and thick books bound. I read it slowly. In the original language, "He gave thanks" reads, "Eucharisteo." I underline it on the page. Can it lay a sure foundation under a life? Offer the fullest life? The root word of Eucharisteo is charis, meaning grace. Jesus took the bread and saw it as grace and gave thanks. He took the bread and knew it to be gift and gave thanks. But there is more, and I read it. Eucharisteo, thanksgiving, envelops the Greek word for grace, charis, but it also holds its derivative, the Greek word chara, meaning joy. Joy. Ah, yes, I might be needing me some of that. That might be what the quest for more is all about. That which Augustine claimed, without exception, all try their hardest to reach the same goal. That is joy. I breathe deep, like a sojourner finally coming home. That has always been the goal of the fullest life. Joy. And my life knew exactly how elusive that slippery three-letter word joy can be. I think of it then, that night of nightmares, the flailing, frantic, moon-eyed lunge for more. More what? And this was it. I could tell how my whole being responded to that one word. I longed for more life, for more holy joy. That's what I was struggling out of nightmares to reach, to seize. Joy. But where can I seize this holy grail of joy? I look back down to the page. Was this the clue to the quest of all most important? Deep chara joy is only found at the table of Eucharisteo, the table of thanksgiving. I sit there long, wondering, is it that simple? Is the height of my chara joy dependent on the depths of my Eucharisteo thanks? So then, as long as thanks is possible, I think this through. As long as thanks is possible, then joy is always possible. Joy is always possible. Whenever. Meaning now. Wherever. Meaning here. The holy grail of joy is not in some exotic location or some emotional mountain peak experience. The joy wonder can be here. Here, in the messy, piercing ache of now. Joy might be unbelievably possible. The only place we need see before we die is the place of seeing God, here and now. I whisper it out loud. Let the tongue feel these sounds, the ear hear their truth. Charis, grace, Eucharisteo, thanksgiving. Chara, joy, a triplet of stars, a constellation in the black, a threefold cord that might hold a life, offer a way up into the fullest life, grace, thanksgiving, joy, Eucharisteo, a Greek word that might make meaning of everything. When children sleep under the scraps stitched into quilts, and the clock ticks too loudly through the dark hours, and the spiral galaxies spin in space, I lie under the afghan by the fire and read the words of an old sermon. It's weeks later now, and the mind stores things, waiting for such a time when God aligns the stars. I read, "The greatest thing is to give thanks for everything. He who has learned this knows what it means to live. He has penetrated the whole mystery of life, giving thanks for everything." Breath leaves the lung. I whisper in the dark, Eucharisteo. It really might be the mystery to the fullest life. I lie on relief. I might have found the Holy Grail and lost it and moved on. And yet really, hadn't God set the Holy Grail in the center of Christianity? Eucharisteo is the central symbol of Christianity. Thanksgiving. The table with its emblems is the essence of what it means to live the Christ life. Sunday after Sunday in a non-denominational Bible church, we're formally invited to take the bread, the wine. Doesn't the continual repetition of beginning our week at the table of the Eucharist clearly place the whole of our lives into the context of Thanksgiving? And two, it's the most common of foods, bread. The drink of the vine has been part of our meal taking across centuries and cultures. Jesus didn't institute the Eucharist around some unusual, rare, once-a-year event, but around this continual act of eating a slice of bread, drinking a cup of fruit from the vine. 1 Corinthians 11:26 reads, "Whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup," whenever, like every day, whenever we eat. Eucharisteo, whenever, now. Joy, wherever, here. Doesn't Christ at his death meal set the entirety of our everyday bread and drink lives into the framework of Eucharisteo? The Big Dipper lurks low outside the window. Yet how does the framework of Eucharisteo undergird a life? Penetrating the mystery is like discovering galaxies. There's always more. I stand the next morning on planks of light, lying down across the floor, and I bake bread, yeasty dough moist between my fingers. And that one word works me, again and again. Eucharisteo. I won't let it go this time. I'll enter into the mystery. I shape loaves and think how Jesus took the bread and gave thanks. And then the miracle of the multiplying of the loaves and fishes, how Jesus took the bread and gave thanks, and then the miracle of Jesus enduring the cross for the joy set before him, how Jesus stood outside Lazarus's tomb, the tears streaming down his face, and he looked up and prayed, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me," John 11:41. And then the miracle of a dead man rising. Thanksgiving raises the dead. The empty, stiff cadaver surging, the veins full of blood, the alveoli of the lungs filling with oxygen, the coronary arteries full of the whoosh of thrumming life. How there is thanks, and then the mind-blowing miracle. I lay loaves into pans and feel years of the angst lying down too. Eucharisteo. Thanksgiving always precedes the miracle. The bread rises. And I stand in the kitchen stirring a kettle of lunch's lentil soup, the one that calls for the salsa and the carrots and the hungry children, and I read while stirring. And I have to sit down to let the words find their places. The only real fall of man is his non-Eucharistic life in a non-Eucharistic world. That was the fall. Non-Eucharisteo, ingratitude, was the fall. Humanity's discontent with all that God freely gives. That is what scraped me raw, ungratefulness. Then to find Eden, the abundance of paradise, I'd need to forsake my non-Eucharisteo, my bruised and bloodied ungrateful life, and grab hold to Eucharisteo, a lifestyle of thanksgiving. Might a life of Eucharisteo really work the miracle of God communion? I rise from the chair. That's when I began to track it whenever I open my Bible, the red pen in hand, hunt down the trail of Eucharisteo through Scripture. Where it leads, barbs, and I'm surprised and I reel. On the night when he was betrayed, the Lord Jesus took some bread and gave thanks to God for it. Then he broke it in pieces. 1 Corinthians 11:23-24. Jesus, on the night before the driving hammer and iron piercing through ligament and sinew, receives what God offers as grace, charis, the germ of his thanksgiving, Eucharistia. Oh. Facing the abandonment of God himself, does it get any worse than this? Jesus offers thanksgiving for even that which will break him and crush him and wound him and yield a bounty of joy, chara. The mystery always contains more mysteries. Do I really want this way? I listened to Matthew 11 for a whole week while exercising, panting hard, skin flushed with life, before I snare this truth, and it snares me. Then Jesus began to denounce the cities in which most of his miracles had been performed, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! If the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Sodom, it would have remained to this day. Matthew 11, 20, 21, 23. And then what does Jesus directly do in the face of apparent failure, when no one responded to his teaching and things didn't work out at all? He lives out Eucharisteo. At that time, precisely at that failing time, Jesus answered and said, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth. Matthew 11, 25. In the midst of what seems a mess, in the tripping up and stumbling down of all hopes, Jesus gives thanks. What precedes the miracle is thanksgiving, Eucharisteo, and it is a Greek word with a hard meaning that is harder yet to live. Do I really want to take up this word? But I wonder at one Sunday, as they pass the broken loaf on the plate of silver, from Paula Vandekamp to Ron Collins to Tammy Lindsay, reaching for it over her kids. Maybe I already take up Eucharisteo's hard meaning every time I take communion. In a very tangible, physical act, aren't I enacting my thanksgiving for his pain? In a very real way, in a digestible, consuming oneness way, I'm celebrating greater gain through great loss. Is not the cup of thanksgiving for which we give thanks a participation in the blood of Christ? And is not the bread that we break a participation in the body of Christ? 1 Corinthians 10:16. The Eucharist invites us to give thanks for dying, to participate in his death with our own daily dying, and give thanks for it. Then Mrs. Klumpenhauer passes me the silver plate, and I tear off my small chunk of bread, chunk of the dead and risen again wheat. I feel the granules between the fingers. I lay the torn bread on the tongue, and I remember, and press it to the roof of my mouth, and the bread melts, and I give thanks for the dying. I swallow it down. This constellation in the dark, grace, thanksgiving, joy, it might be like that, reaching for stars. So hard, so hard. Is there some easier way to the fulfilling life? The day I peel back chapter 17 of Luke's Gospel, I think I have my answer. I sit at the prayer bench before my bedroom window. Outside, our boys roll millions of flakes into a snow fort. I read the passage, one I remember from the musty basement of the Knox Presbyterian Church Sunday School. I think I know this one. Jesus restores 10 lepers to wholeness, and only one returns to offer any thanks. I remember the moral, too. Mrs. Morrison and her glossy red lipstick. How often do you remember to say thanks? Yes, I think I know this one. I skim. One of them, when he saw he was healed, came back, praising God in a loud voice. He threw himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him. He was a Samaritan. Luke 17, 15, 16. Yes, thankfulness, I know. Next verse. Jesus asked, were not all 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? Was no one found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? Then he said to him, rise and go. Your faith has made you well.